Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. An ongoing investigation by CAP Radio and NPR's California Newsroom is following promises made and accomplishments claimed by Governor Gavin Newsom when it comes to protecting the most vulnerable communities in the face of what already is proving to become another historic wildfire season. Today, we dig into wildfire priority projects meant to get ahead and prevent deadly catastrophes like the 2018 Camp Fire. But after looking deeper into claims of success, the effectiveness of wildfire fuel breaks are being called into question after it was discovered at least one fell short. That was during the lava fire in Siskiyou County, leaving some evacuees stuck in traffic. CAP Radio state and government reporter Scott Rodd joins us now with his investigation into the state's wildfire initiatives, what fell short, and the impact on residents. Scott, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we caught up with you last week at the River Fire in Nevada and Placer counties near Colfax. You're actually on your way to another wildfire today, correct?
That's right. I'm heading up to the Dixie Fire, which is now the second largest fire in state history. It's approaching 500,000 acres, and it stands at only just over 20% containment. So it's proving to be a very difficult fire for crews to get a hold of. Over 5,000 firefighters are on this, so the state and the federal government are certainly throwing everything that they can at it, but it's proving to be a pretty stubborn fire.
Yeah. Well, with all of that in mind, you've been investigating if promises made on wildfire management were actually kept. And in your latest reporting, in your latest investigation, you found that Governor Newsom's wildfire priority project didn't contain the lava fire, which happened in late June, leaving evacuees stuck in traffic.
That's right. We've been looking at these priority projects that Newsom laid out early in his tenure as governor now for a couple months. And we took a specific look at this most recent story at a fire at a fuel break that was up in Siskiyou County, in particular because it had contact with the lava fire, which was one of the first big fires of the season.
Well, remind us what Newsom's priority projects were supposed to do. I mean, he announced them a couple years ago.
That's right. This was part of really his first initiative on wildfires. Right when he got into office, he held a press conference and he said, look, we need to do more and we need to change how we approach both fighting fires, but perhaps more importantly, trying to prevent or mitigate the fires in the first place. So he laid out a set of policies, and one of the most prominent ones was these 35 priority projects that would cut fuel breaks, thin forests, do prescribed burns, and so forth, with the goal of protecting some of the most vulnerable communities in California from wildfires. So an earlier investigation that we did took a look at just what kind of work those projects did. We actually found that the governor had claimed that the state did 90,000 acres of work on those projects. We found that, in fact, they had done less than 12,000 acres of work. They later claimed that those 90,000 acres were protected by the work that was done. So, again, these projects are meant to protect some of the most vulnerable communities in the state from wildfires.
And a fuel break in Siskiyou County, which you looked further into, was one of them, and that was near the community of Lake Shastina. So what was the purpose about that specific project?
So the purpose of that project, they cut a fuel break along a main highway called Highway 97, which was the main roadway into and out of this town, Lake Shastina. And they also cut a fuel break along two connecting roads. And the main purpose, the stated purpose of this project, was to allow for the safe evacuation of residents. In the project description, it was described as critical, this fuel break, in order to allow for that safe evacuation. And we found that the lava fire, which had started on federal land near Mount Shasta, it started to spread rapidly, and it came down the base of the mountain and encountered this fuel break and essentially just blew right through it. And not only did the fuel break not contain the fire, but it also caused a traffic jam when folks were trying to leave the area and were under an evacuation order that came down pretty quickly. So folks had to pack up on relatively short notice and get out of the area. And a lot of them went to go down this main highway out of town. However, they met a roadblock and essentially were told to turn around. But folks that I spoke to said that they weren't given directions exactly how to get out of the area. So some folks I talked to just said that they, you know, followed a line of cars that were leaving the area in hopes that other drivers knew where to go. I actually spoke to a woman named April Williams, and this was her exact experience. And she spoke to, you know, sort of this pretty harrowing experience she had trying to leave the area.
I looked outside and it was like all red and so much smoke. And they were like, you have to get out of here now. And I'm like freaking out, because I was not prepared, okay? I had to get my cats, and that was really my biggest concern, was getting my cats out the house. One of my cats ran underneath my bed, and I spent an hour trying to pry her from under the bed while my other cat was locked in my car, so he wouldn't jump out. And I know he was hot and stressed the heck out. But yeah, so then after I had spent so much time loading my cats up, I just got in my car, grabbed a few things. It was scary because, you know, when you're leaving and you see everybody in the streets kind of like panicking and stuff, so I was just trying to get the heck up out of there. Everybody was kind of getting stuck, you know?
And again, April said that she drove towards this main highway out of town where this fuel break was cut. However, those roads were closed and she was turned around and hit a traffic jam. And just, you could sort of hear in her story that evacuations can be messy. You know, even if you have a plan laid out, you know, things will change. Cats will run under the bed. You will have to gather your stuff at a moment's notice. So these evacuation routes, these fuel breaks, if they're meant to create a safe evacuation option for residents, it's really crucial.
Yeah, and not to mention, in addition to all of that understandable panic that they're going through, I mean, the wildfire can change direction as well, just given the direction that the wind is blowing.
Exactly. And if the wind in this fire had blown in a slightly different direction, it would have went more directly at the town of Lake Shastina. Fortunately, it was blowing in a slightly different direction. It still destroyed over a dozen homes. So, you know, this was a destructive fire. This was a fire that had impacts on the community up there. Fortunately, there were no fatalities. There were no injuries as a result of the fire, which is obviously a very good thing. But as you noted, if conditions change at a moment's notice, with regard to this fire especially, things could have been very different.
So with everything that you learned when you took that to the state, did they think that this fuel break project was a failure?
No, Cal Fire actually says that this fuel break was a success. And I think this is some of the most interesting pieces of the reporting that we did, was teasing out this nuance of why the state believes it was successful, whereas why some residents believe that it wasn't really as effective as perhaps the state made it out to be. I spoke to Cal Fire's Siskiyou unit chief, Philip Anzo, and here's what he had to say about why he believed the fuel break worked.
I believe it was successful in the fact that we were able to move those people out of the area safely and efficiently. It also helped our firefighters create that location where they could make a stand, or try to make a stand against this fire.
And Cal Fire actually released a study shortly before this project was completed where they looked at fuel breaks and the purpose of fuel breaks. And they said that these projects aren't necessarily designed to contain fires on their own. You know, as the unit chief there just said, you know, it allows for crews to attempt to create a containment line to try to put out spot fires as they're approaching, but it's no guarantee that it'll be able to stop it. It may slow it down, which can be obviously important on its own, especially if you're trying to evacuate folks. But they claim that just because the fire broke through the fuel break, it doesn't mean that it was a failure.
Hmm. I know that you have attempted to reach out to the governor on multiple occasions with these investigations. Did you get a response from his office?
They declined an interview request. However, a spokesperson did respond via email. And, you know, they said that fuel breaks are not meant to be a panacea, right? They're not supposed to be the only answer in the effort to fight fires and to implement fire prevention and mitigation. They say that it's just one tool in the toolbox of these fire prevention efforts.
Hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd about his latest investigation surrounding the lava fire in Siskiyou County. Well, how do residents feel about the fuel break? I mean, do they believe it was a success?
I alluded to this earlier, that residents are more skeptical about the success of the fuel break. You know, I spoke to a number of them in this community near Lake Shastina, and some said that they were aware that the fuel break was there. They saw the weeks of work that was done on it a couple years ago. Others weren't aware that it was there, but when they found out, they were somewhat surprised. And, you know, they said that they were appreciative that this work was done, that this fuel break was cut. However, they were a bit more skeptical in terms of calling it a success. You know, they saw the fire come through. It came through very intensely, and it burned through this fuel break. They also saw what was at times fairly chaotic evacuation. As you mentioned before, there was some traffic backup, there were road closures, and it was somewhat unclear for some folks where they needed to go. So they were less, you know, apt to come right out and say this thing worked exactly as planned. A number of people I talked to said that they again appreciated the effort, but they think that something else should be done. More work should be done, perhaps more fuel management. But they also say that, you know, there isn't a clear answer to this. You know, this is a very complex problem.
You know, what I'm hearing is when you're talking to residents and then when you're talking to the state, is there are different definitions of what is successful? I mean, at the top of our conversation, you were saying that, you know, originally the state claimed 90,000 acres were treated. It was actually less than 12,000. However, they said that it actually protected, you know, roughly 90,000 acres. They call the fuel break a success, but by a different definition. So is there a language problem here, or should there be a better way of communicating to the public what the intention of these projects are?
You know, I think that's a great point, and I do believe that communication here is essential. And I actually spoke to the former chief of CAL FIRE, Ken Pimlott, about this topic, and he said that it's essential for public officials and for the state to clearly communicate to the public and to communities, you know, what are the purposes? What's the purpose of these projects, these fuel breaks? You know, what are they supposed to do? But also, what are the realistic expectations and limitations of these? Because, you know, as we discussed before, CAL FIRE says up front that, you know, these aren't supposed to necessarily contain fires. And Pimlott says that if the state doesn't do an effective job of communicating, you know, what these projects do or don't do, it could create a false sense of security for folks living in these communities, which obviously is dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. When they themselves have to make that decision of whether they're going to leave or whether they're going to stay.
Exactly. I mean, you know, that false sense of security could impact how they prepare for an evacuation, or whether they believe that they may or may not have to evacuate in the first place. So, again, that communication between public officials, between the state and the public is just so essential.
You know, we're talking about wildfires as the state is in a drought throughout, you know, the overwhelming part of California. Your reporting found that the fuel breaks are potentially becoming less effective due to climate change. What exactly does that mean?
Again, speaking to former CAL FIRE chief Ken Pimlott, you know, he said that these fuel breaks can be an effective tool, sometimes a very effective tool under quote unquote normal conditions. And he sort of referred back to maybe, you know, 10, 15 years ago, or if you think about, you know, when we're not experiencing severe drought, when we're not experiencing record low fuel moisture levels, high winds, repeated heat waves, which seems to be sort of the new normal now, unfortunately. But he was saying that, you know, under conditions that don't match that, fuel breaks can be effective. But when you have that high heat, when you have winds and dry fuels, you're seeing these fires kind of just, you know, fairly easily blow through some of these fuel breaks, being able to jump over them with spot fires. You know, when the winds pick up, these fires can have embers cast well ahead of it. And that really poses a problem for crews. And so Pimlott advocates for actually building these fuel breaks bigger, looking at using a variety of efforts to do this, such as mechanical thinning, prescribed burns, and then over time, maintaining these fuel breaks with herbicides. And so this is something that, you know, it's something that requires, you know, buy-in from all sides, from the folks doing the work, but also from environmental groups and, you know, from the public as well. So just advocating for bigger fuel breaks, it sounds like a simple solution, but it's actually probably something that would be challenging to achieve. But there seems to be an agreement that this work, there needs to be more of it done, more aggressively done. And in the case of fuel breaks, probably building these bigger and maintaining them more frequently.
Yeah, especially for the long term. Scott, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd about his latest investigation surrounding the lava fire in Siskiyou County. And Scott is joining us live as he heads to the Dixie Fire in Plumas, Butte, and Lassen counties. You can follow Scott's reporting on the Dixie Fire this week on capradio.org. Up next, a look at how the pandemic is widening the digital divide and what's being done to close that gap, and the many ways COVID is shaping special education. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We are long past the days where the internet was simply a luxury. It's now essential, from growing your business, searching for jobs online, accessing telehealth. And what we've come to learn during the pandemic, remote learning, virtual classrooms for children and young adults, and even the convenience of accessing a vaccine through an online appointment. But according to the Washington, D.C.-based think tank, the Brookings Institution, roughly 13% of Americans don't have access to reliable or affordable internet. I mean, we're talking about 50 million people who are just not online for a variety of reasons. President Biden wants to do something to fix this digital divide. In the president's $1 trillion infrastructure plan, now backed by the Senate, there's $65 billion set aside to ensure every American has access to reliable and affordable broadband internet. Our next guest has been researching the wide sweeping consequences of the digital divide in our country and globally. Dr. Nicole Turner Lee is the director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Turner Lee joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. Turner Lee, I mean, let's just define the terms. When we say digital divide, we may think of just like one thing, like the internet. But what exactly do we mean, and who are we talking about?
Oh, that is such a great question. I mean, look, we have always had a digital divide before the pandemic, right? It was just something that we weren't really paying attention to. When we talk about the digital divide, this has been a decades-old problem where there are people who are connected to the internet, whether through broadband at home or somehow through a Wi-Fi service. And there are people who have access to a device or they don't, right? So you either have access to a device or you have access to service. And we've sort of defined the digital divide along those binary terms. What the pandemic did, which is so different, is it's extended the definition of what the digital divide is. It's no longer about whether or not you have a device or you don't, or you have, you know, a service or you don't. It's about whether you're able to complete many of the things you just talked about. Are you able to learn? Can you actually, you know, work? Are you able to visit your doctor? Can you get a ride-sharing service? All of these things matter when you begin to really compile just how important being connected is.
Yeah, I mean, and in your research, I mean, you're currently kind of researching the country and going on a tour talking about this digital divide, and the consequences is that the internet is creating a new underclass. Can you unpack that for us?
Oh, I certainly can. Look, I'm just going to do a shameless plug. I have a book coming out on this, and I'm really excited from the standpoint that no one has really encapsulated just how difficult this problem is to solve. You know, I started out in this debate when I was just, you know, one of those folks working in a technology center, helping kids get online for, I'm going to date myself, for things like the Encarta, when we had CDs and DVDs, right? We weren't even looking at MP3 and SoundClouds and all this other stuff. And back then, what really dawned on me is the fact that there were some of us that had access to these things as a privilege. We could afford to pay for it. We had it accessible within our communities. And we were intuitively aware of how to use these tools. You fast forward to today, and there are many young people people, many adults, many older Americans, people from rural areas, people who are foreign born, people who are poor or without a high school education that do not have these luxuries. And we're now at the stage where this is no longer considered a luxury when you have to be dependent upon getting online to go to school, to work, to see your doctor, to shop, because of social distancing sort of precipitated by this pandemic. And so when I think about the digital divide today, I really think about the fact that we are at this state where if we do not connect most of society, we're going to have this digitally invisible underclass. And they're not going to be people of color, right? The people we traditionally somehow think about, we profile as those that are underclass. It's going to be farmers and older Americans. My mom, who is just unable to connect to resources that are most critical, right, to navigating through this 21st century economy.
All right, we are back. Dr. Turner Lee, are you there?
I am. How embarrassing that is that my internet connection failed.
It's a very timely hiccup given the conversation that we're having. So, and I think it really hits home the importance of having reliable internet, and not only reliable internet, but also affordable broadband internet, because it's not just about income, about whether you can whether you have access to the infrastructure, but you need to be able to afford it as well. Correct?
Yes. And I think that's one of the things that came up in this pandemic, the fact that people were making constant decisions between broadband and bread. And so one of the things that we saw happen as part of the stimulus, for example, is we saw the release of the emergency broadband benefit. And this emergency broadband benefit, which provides, and this is for listeners who are not aware of this program, $100 for a device, it's a one-time payment, and $50 that would actually help subsidize the cost of broadband service. We literally saw 3 million people sign up in less than 2 months. And that really speaks to the fact that in addition to the long lines at unemployment and the long lines at food pantries, that people needed broadband. I think when we start to look at how many kids were sent home from school, 50 million to be exact, out of that, 9 million of those kids did not have either home broadband access or a device. Those are problematic statistics when we now look at 14 months later, the fact that many of those kids will have big learning losses. And so going forward, it is so important to make broadband affordable. People have to be connected nowadays. I'll just tell you one other thing that was really troubling during the pandemic, and it was something that I figured out with my book, Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Created to Underclass, that there were teachers, in addition to students, sitting in the parking lots of Taco Bell's and McDonald's. Not to say anything about their food, right? But they were doing their homework there. And these are folks that we needed to be online to either learn or to be the teacher. And so it's things like that that we have to move ourselves out of the way and ensure that affordability is actually touched upon.
Yeah, I mean, when looking at that, those anecdotes that you shared about kind of using the Wi-Fi at a fast food restaurant, I mean, I remember those happening here in California. What stands out to you about California when it comes to this issue?
You know, California has been interesting. I actually just spoke to Representative Becker about this, where we're actually seeing the state legislatures take this seriously. Part of the good thing about California is that you have the political will to want to do something about this. California just made a huge commitment to the digital divide. On the other hand, you have the same challenges of managing sort of an unleashed pandemic that just won't end. And so I think what we're finding with the digital divide, this is very apparent, for example, in the back-to-school efforts, that though we have to solve these digital disparities to make sure that kids who may actually be subjected to the COVID variant, let's just say the Delta variant, that they can learn, we're still sort of pushing the digital divide further at the bottom of the list when really we need to make sure as a country and as a state that no child is left offline. And so California really suffered early on in this pandemic because they had a huge number of low-income kids that did not have digital connectivity. And so California, like New York City Public Schools, for example, were one of the first to completely close in March, in April, right? Very early in the pandemic. And I recall reading and actually talking to superintendents out of the Los Angeles United County School District, for example, where they had thousands of kids that had fallen off the rosters simply because they were not, they did not have the appropriate connectivity to get online to register for school. So we've got to solve this issue. And I think California, as I always tell people, I'm from New York, California is sort of like its own country.
It is.
Moving forward with very progressive ideas. But this digital divide issue that we're really addressing right now is national. And we have to have an all hands on deck strategy to make this work.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about President Biden's $1 trillion infrastructure plan, which is backed by the Senate. There's $65 billion set aside, I believe, over the next 8 years to help close this gap. But the president, Biden, isn't the first president who wanted to fix the digital divide. So how does his plan differ from others? And do you find optimism in this plan?
I do find optimism because, as you said, you know, Biden is not the first one to actually engage in infrastructure, but he is the first one to actually take on infrastructure sort of in this New Deal era paradigm, which means that we'll not only have broadband infrastructure, but we'll have broadband jobs, which I think is even more important, right? Because you're talking about the fact that we're going to be building these new networks, whether it's 5G, whether we're going to be expanding fiber, whether we're going to actually expanding cable access, and we're going to need workers, Vicky, right? So this plan, in some respects, sort of couples the workforce development side of broadband with the consumption side. And so for a very long time, we've been focused primarily on consumption to the point that this country doesn't have models for apprenticeships or credentialing or the types of skill sets that you need that are not engineering degrees, right, or where you don't need a coding degree, where you really just need the basic skill to be able to wire fiber or to put up a pole. So I think this is different. You know, Obama, under President Obama, we saw his legacy be, you know, the Connect Ed program where he wanted 95% of the nation's schools and 99% of the nation's schools to be connected to broadband. But he ran into some hiccups. And even Donald Trump, believe it or not, wanted to see the United States as the, you know, masterful 5G nation when it came to our competition with China. But Biden now has this particular task of putting, you know, putting broadband in a place parallel to water and electricity and energy systems in a way that we've not seen it before. The devil will be in the details going forward. And it will also be, and I'll just end here on this question, whether or not we serve those who are the least served first. So we start to look at tribal lands, or we start to look at rural areas in California in particular, or we start to look at very poor people, do we actually provision broadband to them first? Or do we have broadband available from more of a universal standpoint where we start seeing it built up in tourist areas, you know what I mean? Versus really making sure that young kid who's sitting in the middle of, you know, the rural South, perhaps the black rural South or the migrant community of the rural South has access. So that's what I think is going to be the differentiator going forward when we can actually look back at these metrics.
Yeah. Dr. Turner Lee, thank you for spending time with us today and sharing your research.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. This is what I do. And I, like I said, I'm so sorry for the technical hiccup. I've never had that happen, but thank you for having this important conversation.
Oh, that's okay. That's just life. And I love your enthusiasm and your passion.
Thank you.
Dr. Nicole Turner-Lee is the director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, across the country, more than 7 million children, or 14% of all public school students, receive special education services. And the challenges for special education in the age of COVID have been monumental, starting with the loss of care for parents and guardians, the disruption of essential routines, and the absence or distance relationships with classroom aides, therapists, and classmates. Carolyn Jones is a senior reporter for EdSource. She's been reporting extensively on the state of special education and what it looks like here in California. Carolyn joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, happy to have you. In California, special education encompasses more than 700,000 students in K through 12 public schools. Who are these students?
They are students with autism, which has been on the rise for the past decade or so, students who are deaf and hard of hearing, students with developmental or intellectual disabilities, students with cerebral palsy, students with all variety of disabilities.
How do the needs vary between large urban districts and small rural ones? I mean, when I was reading your reporting, I mean, you've even talked about one-room schoolhouses in parts of the state.
Yeah, serving students with disabilities can be very expensive for districts depending on what the students' needs are. And so in urban areas, you know, there's more resources and more population to kind of support these extra services that some students need. But in a small district or a rural district where you might just have one student who has very expensive needs, that could just bankrupt a whole district. It could be extremely expensive. And so the needs really vary. So the state has set up some, you know, some systems to kind of even out the cost, but it still remains very difficult.
When honing in your focus on special education during the pandemic in California, what surprised you?
Well, I'm always surprised, you know, special ed, I've been covering it for a while now. I'm always surprised at the huge variety of children that it encompasses. It encompasses children with reading disabilities, children with severe autism. You know, it's just sometimes, you know, we say kids in special ed and we just sort of lump them in one big group, but it's an incredibly varied and diverse group of children. And I just have nothing but respect for teachers who are trying to address the individual and unique needs of every child in a classroom where you might have such huge variety.
Yeah. When talking about special education, you know, I also think of, you know, students that have language barriers and how they were impacted during the pandemic, not being able to be in a classroom. Did your reporting cover or kind of uncover anything when it came to English learners?
Yeah, I mean, English learners definitely had it tough for sure because they had that extra layer, that extra barrier as far as communicating with their teacher, trying, you know, well, as our previous guest, the previous guest was saying, you know, difficulties getting online, problems with technology, lack of support at home. It's, you know, it was especially tough for English learners. I think for all kids in special ed, learning online was very difficult as it was because some of the services they rely on, like speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, are impossible, almost impossible to deliver virtually. So kids, you know, kids really struggled with that.
The needs are just so unique to each student, especially in special education. Did you find any success stories during distance learning where it actually worked?
Oh, for sure. I mean, some kids loved distance learning, just in the general ed population and in the special ed population. I think particularly school, you know, kids for whom school was kind of a stressful place, either there were a lot of distractions or they had, so, you know, there were social issues or things just kind of moved too fast. Some kids really thrived with being able to work at their own pace in an environment where that was quiet in their own, in the comfort of their own home, some place where they felt secure. And then also, alternately, there were some teachers who just went to heroic lengths to help these kids, going to, you know, children's homes, talking to the parents, meeting with the parents, saying, this is how you help your, you know, this is how you do occupational therapy with your child. I've heard, you know, I was just never ceased to be amazed and awed by the lengths to which some of these special ed teachers went to help their students during this time.
Looking ahead, I mean, a lot of kids are going to be going back to in-person class. What are the biggest challenges that you're going to be focusing on?
Well, what I'm going to be looking at is kind of a possible uptick in litigation as students start going back to school. In California, parents can sue a school district if their child in special ed, you know, if they believe they're not getting the services that they need that are outlined in their education plan. And California, as we all know, is a very litigious state. California has, I think, four times as many special ed lawsuits as the national average. It's a bit of a cottage industry. And because so many kids fell behind during distance learning, and some kids in special ed fell really far behind, there was a concern from school administrators that there's just going to be this onslaught of lawsuits. And so the state budget actually includes some money to cover some of those suits, but then also to provide extra services for kids in special ed. I think it was $450 million to provide tutoring and behavioral therapy and, you know, whatever else kids need, summer after school programs, summer programs. And then also the state put out $100 million for alternative dispute resolution to kind of settle these disputes before they get to court, kind of to increase and improve communication between districts and parents and make sure parents know their rights. And, you know, I think the idea is to build trust, kind of restore trust between parents and schools. So, you know, I think everyone's hopeful that that will work out and, you know, kind of try to cut off some of these lawsuits.
We know that the impacts of distance learning are just so widespread and impacting also teachers as well. I mean, you're talking about, you know, earlier on, like heroic stories of staff going above and beyond for their students. Teacher retention was a challenge before the pandemic, really across the board. How is that impacting special education now?
Well, there was a huge shortage of special ed teachers before the pandemic, and that had been going on for years. It's very, very, it's a really stressful job, and there's a lot of turnover, and it doesn't pay a lot, relatively. And so teacher, yeah, it requires, you know, bottomless pits of patience. And there was a lot of turnover before the pandemic. And then if you factor in trying to teach these children with special needs virtually, I mean, I think a lot of teachers, I mean, there's been a lot, even more turnover since then. Teachers have been frustrated and they feel like they're not getting through to their students sometimes and so on. So the state has also set aside some money to kind of increase recruitment for special ed teachers and really try to boost that pipeline. That's something I plan to follow up on too, just to see if that is actually working. I know we talk a lot about recruiting new teachers, but sometimes, you know, I don't know if this stuff actually is successful or not. So that's something I'll be looking at and trying to, you know, just look for kind of new, you know, maybe recruit parents, you know, to work in special ed classrooms or start at the high school level, find kids in the high schools who are interested in becoming teachers and set up a direct pipeline from there to the local district.
We know that.
So districts are, you know, doing all sorts of things to increase that.
Well, and we know that learning loss is going to be an overarching issue that's going to be a long-term consequence of the pandemic. When you're looking specifically at students with special needs, when it comes to families or even teachers, what kind of support is out there? Because children are going to be returning to the classroom.
Well, schools are hiring, you know, they have a lot of money right now, and schools are hiring more counselors, more therapists, more teachers when they can. And they are, you know, contracting with local nonprofits, community health organizations, behavioral health organizations to try to bolster what's offered at schools. So, you know, the hope is that that will help. I think it remains to be seen. I don't think we really know yet how bad the learning loss is going to be for some students, and we won't know for a while. That's definitely something I'll be watching closely. And also how, you know, all this money that's been budgeted, you know, is it actually reaching the right students too? As, you know, low income students, students in urban areas and in rural areas and lower income areas, those areas will be much more hard hit.
Carolyn, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Carolyn Jones is a senior reporter for EdSource, sharing her reporting on the state of special education in California. Still ahead, more kids and teens are returning to in-person class, as we've been chatting about. That also means less screen time, right? Well, we'll talk about how to limit screen time for K through 12 students. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for staying with us amid all the technical hiccups we've been having this morning. Well, screen time has been up since it replaced classrooms for students during the pandemic. But now, with many K through 12 students returning to in-person class, how much of that screen time is just too much? Parents already toggle between too much and too little control, and the ever-evolving pandemic is complicating things. Dr. Victoria Dunkley is a Los Angeles-based child psychiatrist and author of the book, Reset Your Child's Brain. She joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Vicki. Good morning.
Well, Dr. Dunkley, your book was published in 2015, so you understood the harmful causes of screen time really well before the pandemic.
That's right. I've actually been working on screen time issues for 20 years now. So initially it was just video games, and then it obviously it's become much more complicated.
Your book focuses on electronic screen syndrome, or ESS. Can you just unpack what exactly that is?
Sure. So electronic screen syndrome is just really a description to describe a condition where the nervous system becomes overstimulated from too much screen time. So when that happens, the nervous system goes into a state of hyperarousal, the frontal lobe kind of shuts down, and the child becomes very irritable, has difficulty focusing, is defensive, has a hard time getting things done, and some difficulties with social skills. So it can present in different ways. Some kids get depressed or anxious. Other kids act out and just become more explosive. A lot of kids, they have trouble focusing or getting their schoolwork done. So it looks different in different kids, but it's all kind of that same underlying mechanism in common, which is that their nervous system is in a state of hyperarousal or fight or flight.
You've worked with hundreds of families. What stories stick with you?
Well, just the impact, really, of how powerful it is to remove screens. So I started this years ago when I was working with kids that had a history of trauma, and I noticed those kids, if they even gamed a little bit, would not get better, and conversely, if we stopped gaming altogether, they started to make progress. And I was also working with kids that had tics or Tourette's disorder, and it was the same thing. Some of their tics went away completely. Other kids just got dramatically better. So I started using this intervention of just removing screens completely for 3 to 4 weeks at a time, and lo and behold, all these kids, their grades would go up, their moods would be better, the parents would say, I have my child back, and then we started seeing even more exciting things, like the kids would start reading, and boys are really falling off the curve when it comes to both boys and girls, but especially boys. So seeing kids start to read, you can see their handwriting become more the printing is more clear and neat and organized. And that really is like a manifestation of that frontal lobe becoming more organized. So all sorts of good things happen when you remove the screens.
Well, with that, the past, year and a half, nearly an entire school year for families, I mean, they've had to depend on screen time because it replaced a classroom. That just further kind of complicates things, it seems like.
Right. Yeah. I mean, from what the teachers say, like even kids who are getting straight A's, it was really a lost year. The teachers report that it's becoming increasingly clear that when kids learn that way, they don't really absorb the information, and that's what the research shows as well. They may be able to spit things back out, but they don't absorb it in a deep way like we want for deep learning. And there's numerous studies that show that learning from a screen, taking notes on a laptop, all of those things are inferior to taking notes by hand, learning from paper. Those are the ways, the natural ways are the ways that the brain is meant to learn.
And I know that you were just chatting about your research focusing on children suffering trauma or Tourette's. And I know that you've also focused on children diagnosed with ADHD, bipolar disorder, autism, and other disorders. But how does these unhealthy levels of screen time impact children who have not been diagnosed with a disorder?
Well, they end up kind of looking like they have a disorder. So some kids just become irritable or just have trouble focusing, or their parents just say they're really, they're walking around on eggshells all the time around their child because their child is in this state of stress all the time, and they have a hard time handling even minor demands because they're really depleted. So what happens is kids who don't have a disorder, they can look like they have a disorder, or they can just look like one area of their life has really become dysfunctional. So they may be at home, they just may be a mess and hard to manage, hard to interact with. Or socially, they may start to kind of fall apart in their friendships, or they may have difficulties on the playground. But basically, the thing that's in common is really that irritable mood and having trouble regulating emotions. So they might... They break down in tears easily, or they explode easily. Those are kind of the cardinal signs of too much screen time.
Well, finally, in the last minute or so that we have, what parting advice do you have for families as they want to curb this issue, and just kind of some simple solutions in the last minute or so that we have?
Well, I think what would give people the most bang for their buck is really removing screens from the bedroom. There's so much research on just that one thing that it helps kids. Kids who don't have screens in the bedroom tend to weigh less. They sleep more hours per night, and they have higher grades. So if you're having a hard time trying to getting back to where you were before, that's the place to start. But I will say, I really am guided by, not that I hate technology, but really just what works the best. and the fastest. And really the gold standard is removing screens for, you know, just doing it cold turkey for 3 to 4 weeks. It sounds like it's very difficult in this day and age, but that's really what works the best. And parents always say it works better, you know, it was easier than they thought it was going to be.
I think that would help adults as well. Dr. Dunkley,
yes.
Thank you for joining us. Make the whole family better.
Right, yes.
Dr. Victoria Dunkley is a Los Angeles-based child psychiatrist and author of the book Reset Your Child's Brain. Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. Thank you.